Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monaco Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. Coming up, we sit down with the founders of an exciting new South African cocktail festival.
The quality of the brand, our love and the community that we built around it was really, really effective and was also great fun.
Also on the programme, we head to California to meet a rising star in the world of baking.
You know, how to make a Genoise cake or how to make a ganache or what does it mean or how do you fix this when it breaks? And then you take those lessons and then start to make your own recipes.
Plus, we sample some sweet treats in the French Alps before the ski season comes to a close. All that here on The Menu on Monaco Radio. Over the last few decades, the rising interest in cocktails and spirits has led to an explosion of worldwide festivals dedicated to the art of mixing tipples. From established conventions in bustling cities like New York and London to ingredient-led local meetups, it's clear that hosting conversations around how to make the best-tasting drinks continues to be popular. However, despite this global interest, Africa was often left off the guest list when it came to these festivities. But that is about to change with the launch of a new event in South Africa. Ajabu, which is billed as the continent's first international cocktail and spirits festival, is the brainchild of Colin Asare Appia and Mark Talbot-Holmes. The event, which will be hosted over 2 weeks in Johannesburg and Cape Town, will bring together bartenders from venues in several countries, including Kenya and Ghana, and looks to celebrate the growing cocktail-making community across the continent.
I met Colin back in about 2000, when the cocktail culture just kicked off in London, but was very erratic in quality. And I arrived at a bar called The Circus in Golden Square about 9 o'clock one evening and went up to the bar, which was quite crowded. And this beaming bartender came to me and said, "What would you like?" And I said, "I'm not sure because I'm so disappointed with all the cocktails I've had." He said, "I'm now going to make you the best cocktail you've ever had." And sure enough, he did. And Colin and I became friends from that day onwards. And when I decided to create a vodka brand called Julovka Vodka, the first person I went to see was Colin. And Colin and I then became partners in the venture. And we realized that as a small luxury vodka brand with very little finance for marketing, our only secret weapon was love and community and quality. And so the quality of the brand, our love and the community that we built around it was really, really effective and was also great fun, because the most important thing is when you're creating anything is you want to have fun with the people you're working with every day. And it was, because we've created the spirit of delight, and that's exactly what we spread with everybody. So Ajabu is all about community, and this is where I'm going to hand over to you, Colin.
Yeah, Colin, could you tell us, I guess, how you went from the drinks brand into the festival, and why create a festival and why create it where it is?
Yeah, I've been involved in the spirits industry for all of my adult career. To the chagrin of my parents, they expected me to be a lawyer, a doctor, classic West African parents syndrome. I decided that I actually wanted to work in the industry, because I loved the community, I loved the people that I met, and I loved to see the delights in people's faces when I made them. Cocktails, instant gratification. The industry is welcoming to all, and the community is amazing. I've had the opportunity of moving from the UK to the US and watching the cocktail culture and the cocktail community grow over the years. Something that I've always noticed was these cocktail festivals were places that people built community and they built their careers, they networked, and these cocktail festivals helped to educate and connect people from all around the world. And I realized, being a proud African, that we didn't have enough of them on the continent. And Mark and I had been to Cape Town in South Africa a couple of times. And while we were there, I remember Mark and I talking about the fact that wouldn't it be great to have a festival in South Africa that celebrated all that South Africa has to offer to the world, and also give people an insight of what's happening in South Africa and also the continent at large. And when Mark and I were discussing the cocktail festival, we realized that there was a real opportunity and there was also a real appetite for people locally to want to be involved in something. We decided to maneuver the festival in a different way, more so than any other traditional festival. Traditional festivals whereby you have all these brands turning up in these conference venues where people bring their banners and their bottles and they talk about their brands, they talk at people, and then everyone leaves. And that's kind of the traditional standard festival. We thought we'd do it a little bit differently and we'd intentionally build community from the ground up. So we'd use spaces and places that people would congregate, which are bars, and we would drive people to bars. And within those bars, we'd invite some of the best international bartenders around the world to work with the best local bartenders to create unique and bespoke experiences for consumers. This helps the community because it helps the bar owners and the bartenders because it puts money in their pockets. It also gives them incredible visibility and it helps build these amazing relationships, which we know is going to happen with Ajabu, with the connections that people are already making. They're already creating some really interesting new cocktails, which I'm really excited to try.
Mark, I find it interesting that the festival is actually going to take place across two different cities, first in one and then in another. Why split it across Joburg and Cape Town? And how do you think that the two different chapters of the festival are going to go? What's different in the scenes of each city that will bring a specific flavour to the event?
That's a good question. And obviously, everybody knows Cape Town a lot better than Johannesburg or Joburg or Josie, as they call it locally. And it's been quite a big learning curve for both of us learning about South Africa. So we're still very much novices on that level. But what's interesting as a newbie to Johannesburg is that it's obviously the financial capital. It's where gold was originally found. So it's a much more structured, different atmosphere to Cape Town, which is much more sunshine, Mediterranean, if you wish, Southern Hemisphere Mediterranean, and a beautiful seaside Cape lifestyle. Both cities are dynamic, full of different people, full of different energies. Johannesburg is a lot more spread out. So if you're going from bar to bar, you normally have to take a taxi, which we've tried to avoid in Johannesburg by putting most of the festival on one block, which we discovered, which has five or six great bars, and there are only two bars that are 15 minutes away. And in Cape Town, most of the bars are all within one quartier of Cape Town, which is very lively, magical, and full of energy.
Colin, I'd like to bring you in here. Obviously, there are plenty of cocktail festivals around the world, but there has been a slight dearth of them in the African continent. I want to ask you, why did you pick South Africa as a location? What makes South Africa and its cocktail scene special and somewhere that you wanted to highlight as part of this? And also, where else in the continent can you see interesting spots where things are happening in the world of cocktails?
We opened a lab bar, which was the first out of the country bar in Cape Town. I think it was 2002, myself, Douglas Anker and Richard Hargroves. A cocktail was created, well, the inspiration for the cocktail, the Porn Star Martini, occurred actually while Douglas was in Cape Town. And as I don't know if you're aware, but Douglas Anker is one of my best friends growing up, fellow Ghanaian. And he created a cocktail from his experiences in Cape Town. And the Porn Star Martini has become a modern phenomenon. And he passed away a few years ago, and it just made sense that if we were going to pick a city and a country, we should start it in South Africa in memory of someone like Douglas. But also, the cocktail culture in Cape Town and Johannesburg is very sophisticated, and we wanted to shine a light on the work that people were doing. After the pandemic, focus on Africa has just grown exponentially. And we brought people like Leah van der Werter, who's working with us and is a partner of ours on this festival, one of the most eminent spirits writers on the continent at the moment and sits on some very illustrious chairs and panels around the world. Kojodu, who owns Frontback in Ghana, Lara Rara, who owns the Lagos Cocktail Festival, she was involved as well. And we also had Richie Barrow from Nairobi. He has Hero Bar. And his bar and also Frontback in Ghana are both bars that are featured in what we have these listings called 50 Best, which everyone clambers to try and be a part of because it gives you a massive spotlight and great visibility in the world. And there's exciting things happening in other parts of the world and other parts of the continent. And they are definitely the flag bearers for them. In Nairobi, for example, there's other fledgling cocktail festivals that are starting to really take hold. There's a great cocktail community there. In Nigeria, Lara's really flying the flag for the local cocktail community there. And then also you have an area, Ghana, which is my country of birth, where you have an amazing cocktail scene being spearheaded by Kojo and his team from back. I've been investing in the Ghanaian bar community for most of my adult cocktail life since I moved here to the US, and I've seen how much it's grown over the years. And the fact that we're able to do a cocktail festival in South Africa and have the opportunity to highlight some great work that's happening on the continent shows the growth that's happening in Africa at the moment. There's so much to see and so much to do, and there's so many great places. The Year of Return obviously shone a massive spotlight on Ghana, as I said, and we have an opportunity with our festival to have the same kind of impact, and I think we're going to have it.
Mark, just one more question for you. What are you looking forward to the most? Any specific mashup cocktail between these 10 people who are coming from abroad and the 10 cocktail bars on the ground? Any specific highlight that we should definitely be lined for?
Yes, I think this is very much about connecting, collaborating and creating cocktails. And what I think in my life has been so magical is that when you put 20 incredible geniuses in a room together, they're going to create some magic, which you don't know what they're going to create yet. And so connecting all of these incredible bartenders in Africa, in South Africa, and from across the world into one place with all these incredibly diverse ingredients and talents, something magical is going to happen. And that's what I'm excited about. Besides the friendships we're going to make, the fun we're going to see, and the friendship and the love and the pleasure that we're going to celebrate when we're all there together. It's going to be quite magical, and in Cape Town.
Mark Talbot-Holmes and Colin Asare-Appiah there. Ajabu begins in Johannesburg on the 10th of March. You're listening to The Menu. If you're looking for the best pastries in San Francisco's Bay Area, those in the know will probably direct you to One House Bakery. After earning her pastry diploma at Le Cordon Bleu in Ottawa and cutting her teeth at some of the most exciting Californian kitchens, its Torontonian founder, Hannah Lee Pervin, decided it was time to follow her dream of becoming a baker. Since 2018, her venture has become a thriving community outpost where visitors can find an original menu of French pastries as well as traditional American and Canadian sweets. All her bakes use delicious, unprocessed ingredients and flour freshly milled on site each day. Not only that, One House's mission is to break down the barriers between the front and back of house with its open warehouse space, allowing customers a real insight into the workings of a thriving bakery. Monocle's Ivan Carvalho met with Hannah Lee Pervin to find out more.
At the age of 10, Toronto resident Hannah Lee Pervin already had a clear idea of what career path she wanted to take, and it involved her love for baked goods. While her dream was to one day run her own bakery, she laid the groundwork after high school by first earning a business degree in the U.S. and then attending the Cordon Bleu Cooking School back in her native Canada.
Being a baker has been the only thing I've ever wanted to do in my life. Growing up in Toronto, with my grandmother and my mom, we'd be baking and cooking pretty much every single day. The way that we showed love to each other was through food, and that's what I've translated into my career. I had a chef in culinary school that said that you can't start experimenting until you know the bases. So every pastry recipe pretty much comes from a base French classic recipe. So in culinary school, that's pretty much what they teach you, is just, you know, how to make a Genoa cake or how to make a ganache or what does it mean or how do you fix this when it breaks? And then you take those lessons and then start to make your own recipes.
Her time at the Cordon Bleu saw Pervan win a national award. After, she secured a job in Napa Valley at Bouchon Bakery, owned by famed American chef Thomas Keller.
When I was working at Bouchon Bakery, it was the first time I had ever seen macaroons made in production, hand-piped. It's a very, very finicky French pastry. You know, we made everything from scratch there. It was the first time I had ever actually learned how to shape bread, because in culinary school, it was all pastry. I didn't know anything about bread at that point. Chef Octavio, who's the head baker at Bouchon Bakery now, he became a mentor of mine and taught me how to shape everything. I'd stay after work and he'd just show me, you know, how to shape baguettes. And it just allowed me to, you know, start finding a new love in bread and not just pastry.
After a stint in Miami, Pervan, with her husband and parents in tow, returned to California and wound up in the San Francisco Bay Area, where they settled in the quaint waterfront town of Benicia to fulfill her wish of starting her own bakery.
As soon as my parents and I saw Benicia when we came here, we immediately fell in love. There was a beautiful little gazebo right when you come down First Street, and it was just like quintessentially like Americana. We got out of the car and people were smiling and waving, and we're like, wow, this is, you know, it reminded us a lot of Canada. It reminded us of, you know, the friendliness.
After renovations on a building once home to a local theater, Pervan opened One House Bakery in the autumn of 2018, quickly winning over locals with delicious treats, including recipes that reminded her of home.
All of our recipes that we make here are my own. I came up with them. Everything we make from scratch. Probably the thing that we're most famous for is our sticky toffee pudding. So it's kind of my homage to Canada. Growing up, you know, being part of Britain, they kind of instilled that love of sticky toffee pudding in us in Canada. So that one is actually 100% whole grain, which most people don't know. We mill the flour fresh. It's an Edison wheat berry. It's grown in Washington, and we added just 10% rye flour to it. Makes it taste like pancakes. When the cake comes out of the oven, you pour as much toffee sauce as it can, like, physically soak up. We also have our blueberry scones, which are very popular. I remember, actually, it took me about a year to figure out this recipe, how to actually get them to not be such a classic scone texture. So we roll out the dough. It's full of buttermilk and sour cream and frozen butter, so it's nice and flaky. Then we spread a house-made jam, a blueberry jam, onto it, and then we put full blueberries onto it. And then instead of scooping or cutting, we actually roll it up so it looks like a roulade kind of thing. We press it down and then cut it into its triangles.
Along with traditional pastries, breads, and specialty coffee served to go, Pervan has gotten creative with the menu, as patrons can also sit down to enjoy a leisurely meal.
Our best sellers, I would say, for savory, definitely savory waffles. We can put braised meat on them, roasted veggies. It's made with a Gruyere base, so it's a Gruyere cheese, like a pate choux base, black pepper. It's super savory, really delicious. You know, our BLTs are very popular, our chicken pot pies. For pastry, our chocolate raspberry roulade. Somebody's at the bakery 24 hours a day. Everything we make here is from scratch, so it's very labor-intensive.
And now this here is this dough for croissants, or?
This is beignet dough, actually. So we take the beignet dough, we roll it up with cinnamon and sugar, put it in the loaves, and it makes an awesome bread for French toast.
5 years in, her business is baking up a storm. Pervan today has 55 employees, up from 8 when she started. And she now counts several veterans of the acclaimed French Laundry kitchen on her staff. Weekend brunch sees a line out the door, as locals in this close-knit waterfront town have welcomed her with open arms. For Monocle, in Benicia, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
Thanks, Ivan. You're listening to The Menu on Monocle Radio. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Monica Lillis.
Wine sales in the UK decreased by 10 million bottles in the build-up to last Christmas compared to 2022, according to new figures from the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. Industry leaders blame the situation on the UK government's decision to increase taxes on bottles last August. The decision has also led to a reduction in tax revenues from wine and spirits as sales declined by £436 million year on year between September 2023 and January 2024. Camembert cheese may be on the verge of extinction, according to a statement from France's National Centre for Scientific Research. This is because the mould that is used to produce France's favourite cheese is experiencing problems reproducing as a result of the pressures of industrial production. Other cheeses, including Brie, Gorgonzola and Roquefort, all face similar fates if cheesemakers don't act in time to save them. And finally, René Redzepi, the founder of famed Copenhagen restaurant Noma, has announced that his kitchen will return for a second residency in Japan at the end of this year. The pop-up will run for around 10 weeks from October the 8th and will be held at the Ace Hotel in Kyoto. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Chiara.
Thanks, Monica. You're listening to The Menu. Courchevel in the French Alps is a paradise for skiers, with 600 kilometres of slopes spread over three valleys. However, as anybody who's ever enjoyed a spot of après-ski will know, a week at a resort is just as much about indulging in what you eat and drink as it is about time on the piste. And there's no better way to end a day in the snow than with a flambéed crêpe Suzette at La Pogée. We're pitched up at the five-star hotel before the season wraps up to enjoy something sweet to round things off. Monocle's Miriam Zumbul reports.
They say that a good day on the slope starts with an athlete's breakfast. While ginger shots and omelette with mushroom and spinach are swiftly served in the cozy Le Comptoir restaurant at Hotel La Pogée, all I can see is the dessert section of the lavish buffet. I admire the freshly baked madeleines and pistachio cake, but my sanity leads me to eat something savory instead. Luckily, the waitress seen me deny myself of the sweet sin and packed me a piece of pistachio cake in a snack box. "It'll taste good on the chairlift," he said, and winked. A few floors down, there is a fun hustle and bustle in the ski room. I sip on a cup of coffee and snack on a warm madeleine while the team straps on my pre-warmed ski boots. And off we go onto the slopes. There is a lot of laughter and joy in the powdered snow, and pistachio cake truly is a great snack on the chairlift. Skiing seems like the thing you do between meals here. A lesson I learn as I ski directly from the piste to the ski room, where I'm welcomed with herbal schnapps to celebrate the day with the team. But the highlight is yet to come. "Have you had a crepe yet?" the concierge asks me in the elevator and sends me straight to the bar in my ski trousers. Head pastry chef Tania Colello has set up an impressive crepe station and buffet of cakes. The Italian chef learned to cook in her grandmother's kitchen and fell in love with French pastry so much that she was willing to leave her beloved home by the beach to work in France. And here at La Pogée, she celebrates the art of French patisserie. Perfect but pure madeleines, tarte Saint-Honoré and tarte au citron. If it's not broken, don't fix it, as the saying goes. And the same goes for the greatest crepe of all, the crepe Suzette. Legend has it the dish was created by accident in 1895 when a young waiter at Café de Paris in Monte Carlo was preparing a dessert for the future King Edward VII of England, whose guests included a beautiful French girl named Suzette. There are plenty of other rumors that surround the dish, but what has stayed consistent is its recipe, which has remained the same for the last 130 years. Tania Colello shows me how to make it. The hot lard skillet is greased with butter and the crepe batter is then carefully poured into the pan. It's key, she tells me, to make sure that the crepes turn out thin and as soft as possible. As Tania carefully watches the small bubbles arise on the top, she loosens the edge of the crepe with a spatula to turn it over and bake it into a golden color. She's turning and folding the crepe just like a napkin into quarters and sets them aside. And the sauce, the beurre Suzette, may seem complicated, but it's simpler than it seems. Sugar is generously sprinkled into the pan and then given a rest until it changes its color to amber. This moment is not to be missed, as it's the moment where it's deglazed with orange juice, lightly stirred until the caramel unites with the fruit juice. Tanya reaches round for a moment and grabs a good chunk of butter. This is the secret ingredient. It's a beurre Suzette, after all. It's her joyful excuse. And it's the butter that brings it all together in this caramel-like sauce. The aromas of sugar and oranges are enhanced by some freshly grated orange peel. The texture now has a creamy sugar syrupy consistency. That's the beurre Suzette. The folded crepes go back in and Tanya bathes them in the sweet syrup to soak up all the wonderful aromas. She then generously pours some Grand Marnier over the crepes, sets the dish on fire and flambés it to perfection in front of my eyes. What a showstopper, I tell myself, and the sweetest rewards after a day on the slopes. For Monocle in Courchevel, Miriam Zumbühl.
Miriam Zumbühl there. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Di Mella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan, Lily Austin, and Tamsin Howard. Thanks for listening, and until next week.